there with the one underneath the plaque is the signing of that law.
Okay.
The key to it was to get the guy, one of the most powerful men in Texas government is the House committee chair who chairs the Calendars Committee. The Calendars Committee sets the time and date when a bill will appear on the floor. So if you're in bad with the Calendars Committee, there are about 5,000 pieces of legislation introduced in any given session, 180 days. No bill can be brought up on the floor prior to March 15th, I think. That's a pretty compressed.
Mm-hmm.
So every lobbyist has had the experience of seeing his bill set to be bill number 798 on the last day of the session. And on the other hand, if you're in good with the Calendars Committee chair, your bill gets to be bill number one on March 15th.
Mm-hmm.
So Bill Messer, who was then and is now, he's now a lobby, one of these lobbyists that gets paid a gazillion dollars, but he was very conservative rep from Killeen area, Temple, Killeen, anyway, in that area. I went to see the speaker and disingenuously said, gee, we've got this bill, but I'm not sure who would be a good legislator to carry that. And he said, well, Bill Messer would be the man. And I said, oh, should I give him that message or will you? And so he picked up the phone. Bill Messer was there in about 5 minutes. And it was a done deal. I mean, that bill went through the house like grease lightning. Nobody wants to mess with the Calendars Committee chair.
Hey.
Any legislator is always terrified that he'll get crossways with him and find his bill on 798 on the last day of the session. We did a lot of other good work during that time. Unfortunately, Mark White lost his bid for re-election and lost it largely because of educators' anger against him. I don't say that they voted against him. I think they sat out the election, and he certainly did not get the kind of support he needed. Like, the NEA affiliate did not endorse anybody in the race.
Mm-hmm.
So.
What was TFT membership like in response to the passage?
Quiet, well, or? At that time we were a pretty cohesive group, and I had a lot of we had lost members, but we picked up a lot more. We lost all our coach members. Linda and I had a meeting in Corpus Christi because she was catching 9 kinds of grief from the coaches down there over no pass, no play, primarily. And I said to her, get a meeting of all the coaches, and I'll come down there and let them yell at me. You don't have to take this heat. And I called Governor White, because I said I'd like to have a prominent athlete. And I knew he was friends with Mean Joe Green. I called the governor and said, could you get Mean Joe Green to come to Corpus Christi with me and speak to this coaches meeting? So he said, sure. I go down there, and Linda, in those days, driving this AMC Pacer. Of course, we're still getting paid next to nothing. We're not making our salaries were less than what we would have been making as classroom teachers still at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I was famous for my cars being driven till they collapsed in a heap, and Linda did too. Anyway, her AMC Pacer, the headliner, had fallen out years before. So it had this orange foam stuff on the top. I go pick up Joe Green. I climb into what passed for a back seat in a Pacer. And Green gets in and sort of fills the car up, just getting in it. And his head just smacks right up against that ceiling. So when he gets out at the hotel, his head is orange covered. Well, anyway, we had the meeting, and I got up, and the coaches all hissed and booed, and I had been quoted accurately as in the papers saying that I was disappointed that the test that we were all having to take did not contain subject matter material, because it wasn't enough to me that you have to just be able to read and write to teach. You have to know your subject. And the law called for it to contain subject matter, but the state ignored that part of the law because school districts, frankly, did not want the consequences of having to hire people with degrees in the subject matter they were teaching. Anyway, so I got up and gave the coaches my speech and told them you can't have a profession, an education profession, where people think you can't read and write. You just can't have it. And agreed, this is not something that we all want to do, but it's a small price to pay to save our profession. So one coach gets up to the mic and he says, it's not bad enough. We got to take this test. Here comes Cole saying, give us a harder one. But Joe Green got up and read him the Riot Act.
I bet.
He told him, he said, I don't know what you're whining about the 70. And he said, my mama had a no pass, no play rule. If I came home with less than an A, I not only wasn't going to play, I wasn't going to sit down. So, anyway.
Also, he's probably a good unionist, too.
I'm sure he was.
Yeah.
I'm sure he was. There was a, it was an exciting time. There was a lot of negative campaigning done by the other teacher organizations, which never bothered me. I found it amusing. We do polls from time to time. My name ID among teachers went from virtually zero to 25% during that period of time. And I attribute it to all the hit pieces that were put out blasting me. In fact, I got calls from people saying, we just got this flyer from the TSDA, and it says how horrible you and your organization are. We want to hear your side. Come out here. So I had the opportunities to go out and time. We started new locals out of this thing through our organizing committee program. We didn't just hand them out charters. We made them go through the whole multi-year program and picked up in the long run thousands of members that way.
Yeah.
So that by about 1990, maybe. This won't go back that far. Well, within, I think, about 1990-91, we actually had the 15,000 members that my predecessor had claimed. And I had taken an oath when I was elected that though I would not announce to the world that my predecessor was a liar, I wouldn't claim any membership growth until we actually hit 15,000. And after that, we would never claim members we didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been an honest organization since that time.
Excellent. And part of this growth was part of your associate membership program?
Yes. In about the same time, actually, when I was first elected, that year, the Association of Texas Professional Educators started its existence. It was started by administrators to be a low-dues alternative to mainly to the NEA because they weren't even aware of us. Now, the Texas Classroom Teachers Association had a different genesis. They had been part of the TSDA. And then when NEA unified with the TSDA, the Texas Classroom Teachers Association pulled out and started its organization independently. So, when I was elected, it did not take me long to see that if we had an organization in those days offering $50 dues with benefits that were equal to or better than those that we offered, our little locals that had no hope of winning any kind of exclusive representation in anything like a reasonable time frame would not be able to compete. And that in places where we did not have a viable local, if we had two choices, we could just leave them alone and not be there with all that that implied, or we could try to compete with a reduced dues membership that would give us at least some presence in those places. Now, about the same time I was thinking this, the AFL-CIO had a task force that came out with a report that was a good news, bad news. Good news, most Americans want to be members of the union. The bad news is they think about $50 a year is right for union membership. And this is a report that most of the AFL-CIO ignored because they did not like the implications of it. Most Americans, the collective bargaining aspect of unionism is lost on them.
Mm-hmm.
They do like the idea of an advocate organization for working people. They don't think it's worth $500, $600 a year, which nowadays $1,000 a year. And Al Shanker was talking about that report. And so I had a Mark Chaikin, who was at that time regional director, and I put together a proposal, which we took to Phil Kugler, and he bought, and then the three of us took it to Al Shanker, and he immediately agreed. And the concept was this would be for places where we don't have locals, where there's not much chance we're going to have a local right away, where we couldn't get to probably anyway, but if we should spot someplace through this program that looks like it might produce a local, then we could use this membership as an entree to get in there and try to organize something. So I think we launched that in 86, around 85, 86 in there. The first results were way below expectations. We learned a lot of lessons a very hard way. And AFT wasted a ton of money employing cannot remember the advertising agency. It's a high-scale New York agency.
Mm-hmm.
And we also squandered opportunities by the thousand because we just couldn't. I can remember, for example, this advertising agency hired what's called a fulfillment house. First time I heard that term, I thought it was a bordello. But it's a place where when you respond to a direct mail pitch, the fulfillment house gets the response and then actually sends you the product, your Popeil pocket fisherman or whatever. And the response to the first mailing we did for our associate membership program was so overwhelming that this fulfillment house fell hopelessly behind and, of course, refused to admit it and didn't say anything about it until a couple of months at least after we, you know, it took us a while to figure out that something was not right, and we finally got somebody to go over there and pick up boxes and boxes and boxes of envelopes with cards in them, some with checks. Thousands of people saying, I'm interested in membership information. And of course, that window had passed at that time. Checks were 6 months old in some cases. It was very disheartening. But we kept plugging away at it, and the associate membership program became a two-prong attack. One, we use it as a way to have people join us where otherwise they would be members of the Cheap Booze outfit, and in places that we are not present and don't want to be organizing, and then we use it to start organizing committees and build them towards locals. There's a lot of tension. Phil Kugler has thought all along that I was way too slow in allowing them to apply for charters. It's always kind of a balancing act. From my point of view, I did not want them to apply for charter unless they could do the six-point program and have sufficient membership to be able to, we could feel like they should be able to sustain themselves over a period of time without constant staff, state staff help. So because state staff, in my opinion, was better used organizing in new areas rather than servicing members in old areas. And the goal should, from my point of view, was to get these groups where they could take care of their own service needs. Phil wanted the charters, and still wants, I'm sure, the charters much more quickly. And if some of them fall by the wayside, well, you wind up with more members than you have. But it's still, all in all, it's a successful program on a scale that nobody else has matched in the state. And I don't think any other union has even come close to trying it.
Was this kind of a case study for AFT? Because they pretty much embraced that association.
We were the first, and at this point we're almost still the only one. The three states where it was tried and tried with some success were Texas, Louisiana, and West Virginia. But West Virginia has a fluke, and their laws, really, West Virginia has a statewide collective bargaining agreement. I mean, they have arbitration on grievances and all mm-hmm. sorts of things. So they offered them, if you pay full dues as a member at large, then you get representation in arbitration cases. Otherwise, you only get the benefits like liability insurance and stuff. And most people were willing to pay the full dues to get that representation. Mm-hmm. Louisiana, they chartered locals the year, like within 1 year after the people were associate members. So they had a lot of many, many little locals, and I cannot say what has happened to them now since the situation there is in such a mess.
Yeah. And also now the AFL-CIO is endorsing associate membership.
Yeah, well, they endorsed it, but here's their problem. AFL-CIO can't do much about that. Although, in my opinion, they should. They ought to create an AFL-CIO membership. But AFL-CIO is not a membership organization.
Right.
They have to rely on their affiliates to do it. So, you're the business agent for a carpenter's local. This doesn't interest you.
You're not going to do it.
Right.
You're not going to do it at all. It
has to come from a level above the local, that's for sure. And at their national art level, if they start experimenting with it, some of their locals are going to start squawking. You mean my carpenters here in this town are going to be paying $800, $900 a year, and you're going to let somebody call himself a union carpenter over in the next town for $100? Now, we had that argument in TFT also. But the idea of saying you're a union teacher isn't, I mean, that isn't significant mm-hmm. as saying you're a union carpenter. There was a fear that employers would exploit this, for example.
And they could, yeah.
I don't see how it works for the AFL-CIO unless they did something very uncharacteristic, and that's reach out into unorganized areas.
I think that's where we're heading, especially the latest is they're going to organize day laborers. The latest thing that they came out with, trying to come up with it after council, they said we're going to go after day laborers in cooperation with a few other unions.
This reminds me of the right after Sweeney was elected, there was this big push to organize strawberry workers. Tres Cerros. Also the blueberry workers, Los Moreros. And since we have disproportionately many more Hispanic staff than anybody else in AFT, when the call came, we emptied the state. And at the time, I said, well, we're going to do this because I believe, you know, we had a lot of help from other places and we have an obligation to respond. But in my opinion, it's a disastrous policy. First of all, anybody who knows anything about them, you will not be successful. But that's good, because the worst thing would happen would be if you were successful. And the union membership in America came to be the membership for people at the bottom rung of economic society. And the reason people wanted to join unions in the past was to move up economically. And you used to see all these comparisons. Union labor earns this, non-union labor that. Farm workers are not going to make those kinds of wages. Neither are day laborers. You're going after a group of people where you better hope you fail. It's like what I was saying earlier about the bus drivers in Odessa. You know, they can't pay enough dues to support themselves. It'd be a huge support structure needed for them. And when all is said and done, you'll be like, it'll be people thinking of you as the organization you join when you're a basket case. Now, on the other hand, the workforce in this country, since the early 80s, the information workforce has exploded. These, by and large, are people who do not think of their employer as Ebenezer Scrooge in a top hat. These are people who come to work dressed like I'm dressed, which I didn't when I was president, who set their own hours, by and large, who work from home when they feel like it, who think of themselves as independent, even if they're employed by Dell. They're thinking of new creative things all the time. This is a far different thing from standing at an assembly line, putting the same screw in over and over again, or going down into a mine and swinging a pickaxe all day. Now, those people, I believe, would join an organization that advanced causes they believe are important. They may not be interested in collective bargaining, and they probably don't want to pay the collective bargaining level of dues. But if you could put together a membership that gave them some of the things that they may not get. This is especially true if you're talking about the, you know, a lot of these computer companies are like three people, five people. They're not going to get group health insurance. They're not going to get much of a 401k plan. Suppose you could do that for them. There's millions of those people out there. And now you'd have to have a product. That's the thing that made our... The associate membership program only worked because the TFT has a product. We have the lobbying efforts, the advocacy campaigns, the newsletter and information flow, the 1-800 number for you to call if you have a question or if your boss has told you to do something and you're not sure what the law is, conferences. You've got to have all that stuff. And in fact, most of those organizations, I think, are being created right now. They're just being created outside of the labor movement.
Well, CWA is trying.
They've done a better job than most.
With WashTec and IBM Blue.
Going to have to think, Dell I would not tackle if I were doing this. I would go after smaller places. You know, I don't know how many million people are out there right now running 1 and 2 person shops doing stuff on PCs, mm-hmm. putting up web pages for people.
Well, look at Wikipedia. 2 people. Now it's, I think, 20, but that's just because it grew so fast.
That's what the AFL-CIO should be thinking about. How can we get there? Because that's also where America's future lies, if insofar as this country wants to maintain itself as a prosperous nation. The present level of things, we're headed for a future as Mexico, with 1% of the people having 99% of the wealth. And, mm-hmm. But the future for the middle class is in those in the service industry as it relates to the information flow and the use of information technology. But anyway, AFT kicked around every now and then. I was on the organizing committee, and they still kick around. Daycare workers. If you've got nobody, if the entire education community is organized, you can take them on as a charity project. We did, in fact, try to organize them back when I was young and desperate, and did organize 2 daycare chains, relatively big ones.
Really?
One of them had 15 sites. One of them had 2 sites. I negotiated 2 contracts. Third contract came along, management decided just to ignore it, and did, including the payroll deduction provision. Reagan's appointed NLRB overturned the lower rulings, which had given them 27 unfair labor violations. We spent I don't know how many $1,000s on legal fees and wound up with not one member to show for it. Mm-hmm. But at the best, when we had it and everything was working, out of 325 employees in 15 sites, we had an FDE, full dues equivalent, of about 100.
Wow.
They can't pay dues. They're making, they don't work full days. Cafeteria people work 2 or 3 hours a day. They pay them very low wages. If you get the wages up high enough that they're anything like decent, management has the repudiate the contract option, or they fold up and go away.
Yeah.
So if you can't collectively bargain for them to do any good, and by the way, those were best case scenarios. Most daycare centers are 1 and 2 person operations.
Mm-hmm.
And very frequently, they're unlicensed. The majority of Texas ones are unlicensed. And they're family.
And they're private homes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what you have to have is something you can offer those people that's worth them paying a little bit for. And of course, if we could offer any kind of health insurance benefit at all, group health insurance, you'd have them signing up right and left.
But is that why the Child Care Workforce Alliance is part of AFT now?
But they've been unable to get around any of the problems associated with it.
Okay. Still trying to build it. Right.
Now, New York might be a different case. You've got New York City there. That local can sustain You know, if they can invest a lot of money just to pick up bodies.
Yeah. The whole state can.
Yeah. And that's a different dynamic.
Completely. So this leads into, when did you start getting involved with more AFT National?
Well, I got elected to the Executive Council in 84, right after House Bill 72. That was a magic year for me.
Were you asked to run, or did you say?
I ran, but I had run before. Uh-huh. And previously running, I knew I would not get elected. In 84, I felt I had a good chance.
Yeah.
Because of the experience of that summer. And then...
were you the first...
First Texas person. Not the first Southerner. No, McCord had been there, and of course, if you count Florida, Pat Tonello, and before him, Richard Batchelder. Mm-hmm. Not to mention St. Louis used to have a VP.
Actually, going way back, Doxie Wilkerson.
Now, that one, I don't know.
Tuskegee. Yeah.
Anyway, but I was the first Texan.
Mm-hmm.
And... sort of a prodigy in the minds of my colleagues. Here's this guy from Texas who's on the council. He has no members to speak of. Why is he here? but Al and I hit it off well from the beginning, and I, of course, worshipped him. It was a good partnership.
Yeah.
This is, you can't read that. That's from Al's wife after he died. She sent me that.
Oh, nice. Nice. Well, this was also, you know, changing time for you, but also for the AFT. The big shift, really, for AFT from bread butter unionism into the realm of education professionalism.
Yes, and since... we were way out in front on that by necessity, collective bargaining being prohibited, and so, and even in Corpus Christi in the early days, we, as I mentioned, we were careful to make our program heavy on education quality matters, education quality issues, rather than bread and butter issues from day one, being sensitive to the fact that unions in Texas are not popular and suspect, and wanting to sort of hit people from left field when, and I always said public relations is like a game of billiards. You have to reach your members, you have to bounce the ball off a cushion, and the cushion is sort of public opinion. And so a president of a union calling a press conference saying we demand a pay raise for teachers is not much news.
Mm-hmm.
At the best, it's worth a little paragraph for one day. President of a teachers union saying we believe every child should be able to read before moving from third grade, and that's our number one legislative priority this year, is a different matter. You have credibility because you're representing educators. It's an issue that the public understands and can support, and it doesn't seem self-serving.
Right.
So we did that campaign starting in 93. Bush picked it up later. For a time, he gave us credit on his webpage.
Did he?
Yeah. 93. No, I was wrong. 97. 93 to 95 was our Safe Schools campaign. Our top priority... we started out with a program that said there should be zero tolerance for guns, knives, or other illegal weapons at schools. zero tolerance for illegal drugs at school, zero tolerance for violence directed against teachers or fellow students, and zero, we initially said zero tolerance for profanity, but we had to drop that because apparently everybody assumes it's part of a teacher's job to be cussed at nowadays. So, but that was one of our more successful campaigns. We had a we got a great law passed on the reading at third grade. We got a great law passed. The difference on reading, when I was going around giving my speech about third grade reading, the speech included 21% of third graders failed to pass the reading portion of our state's exam. That's 21% of kids that will move on to fourth grade unable to read, and fifth grade, because the statistics are, if they don't get it by third grade, they don't get it. The last statistic I saw after we passed that law a couple of years down the road, it's like 95% of our kids passed that test in third grade. First try.
That quickly?
Well, it was a leap. The bill did not take effect totally till 2001. It was phased in. And it included, in the first year after it was enacted, in that summer, any kindergarten teacher who wanted to go back, who wanted to take classes, and the classes were arranged and offered through regional service centers around the state, in the latest techniques for teaching reading, would be paid a stipend to go to those classes. The next year, kindergarten and first grade teachers, same thing. Next year, kindergarten, first and second. Next year, kindergarten, first, second, and third. It also included phasing in a reading readiness inventory, which began the first year with kindergarten, and then the next year was phased in to kindergarten and first grade, and then kindergarten, first and second. So that by the time the test was given, the teachers who those students had had, every cohort of those teachers that were in those grades had been to, or at least had the opportunity, and most of them took it, extra seminars, had learned the latest skills, and in some cases gotten the only instruction on how to teach reading they ever received. Mm-hmm. Since our colleges do a terrible job, teacher prep courses are appallingly bad in that way. And this reading readiness inventory was administered to those students before they took their test in third grade three times, kindergarten, first, second grade. And at each administration, if a student showed poorly on it, the district was required to put that student in a special intensive reading class. And if they showed poorly on it at the end, if they failed after all of that, passed the test the first time in third grade, they had to be placed in a special class with no more than five other students. Mm-hmm. And of course they were required to be given the test repeatedly. So it used the student testing as a diagnostic, and then built the law-required follow-up. Now, I have no illusions about how school districts do these things. They lied like dogs, they cheated, and they cut corners. But still, the evidence is that it made a tremendous change in the number of students learning to read, at least at the level required to pass the state's test. And the state's test got harder during that period.
Has it climbed up?
No, it got harder. It gets harder every year. It's gotten harder every year since 1984. So between the time we passed the law in 97 and 2001, when it first kicked in, that test was upgraded four times. Mm-hmm. Maybe not a lot each time, but the states had a policy of ratcheting up the test a little bit every year since the first time It was put in House Bill 72 back in 84.
So how did Bush mess it up with the Child Left Behind?
Well, the first time that I was asked about that, I said he's got a great idea, that we should do it, but I don't know how you pull it off with an investment from the federal level of equal to 7% of the average school district budget. We had a heck of a time in Texas with, at that time, the state putting in 50%. And so that's the first thing. You have to spend money. You know, those courses offered in the summer, that cost money. The reading readiness inventory, it had to be developed. Mm-hmm. People had to be trained in its use. Cost money. Those remedial courses, they cost money. Now, the law we passed in Texas pumped in something like $125 million just for that purpose. They didn't do anything on that scale at the national level. Second thing they did was they took the coward's way out and allowed states to establish the test. So now you have the perverse consequence. A state like, shall we say, Mississippi. I don't know Mississippi well, but my prejudice is that their test is on about the same level as the little things that restaurants give kids on to color in while they're waiting for their meal. Mm-hmm. That's the test on which their AYP is based. Our test has been 22 years in the making and includes now at the high school level for the first time higher math, sciences. It's still nowhere near where we want it to be, but it's a much more difficult test than the first ones were. And then there's, of course, New York Board of Regents, which is tougher than ours. And everything in between. Mm-hmm. If you're going to do this, you have to have a national test. But nobody at the national level is prepared to fight that battle. Now, which leads to another thing. We have a state curriculum. Mm-hmm. Most states do not have a state curriculum. But if you don't have a national curriculum, how do you decide what should be on the test? The way we do is we have a state curriculum that was adopted first. Then a test was adopted to measure the parts of that curriculum we felt we could get away with measuring. Frankly, it's always been a balancing act between the sticker shock the politicians could stand on the failure rate and covering the whole curriculum. You know, ideally, the test should cover the entire curriculum. Mm-hmm. If we did that, the failure rate would be such that there'd be calls to impeach the governor, which wouldn't be a bad thing, but he knows that, so he's not going to allow it. So your test should flow from what your curriculum is. There's no national curriculum. Most of the states don't have a curriculum for their own state. So what value does the test have? And yet, there are consequences for schools for failing to meet these meaningless standards. Mm-hmm. So, what happens in the long run there, when you give that educators that kind of task, they find ways to cheat. One of the life-changing moments, Al Shanker took a group of us in mid-80s to tour German schools. Saw some wonderful schools. And part of the tour was we went over into what was then East Germany. And that was an eye-opener. Growing up in West Texas, everybody distrusts the government. So I always assumed that all this anti-communist rhetoric was at least half propaganda and maybe more. You know, I sort of filed it under information not to be believed until independent verification is received. And got my first look at a communist country, and it was like, oh my God, it was not only was that true, it fell short of the mark. But while I was there, one of these guys told me a story that I found so precious about, because it rang so true with what was with my experience in schools. In East Germany, a factory manager is called in. His shoe factory is producing way below its quota. They must improve. So he's thinking about, okay, will you let me hire some additional workers? No. My machinery is out of date. Can I update my machinery? No. Well, I'll need more leather. No. Now he's thinking about the Gulag Archipelago. Or, conversely, he goes back and tells his men this message, and they hang him from the flagpole. So he goes back and discusses it with his workers, and they come up with the solution. Previously, a unit of production was a pair of shoes. But now, a unit of production will be a shoe. Within days, they've doubled production at that factory. He gets a medal, they get a flag that declares them all heroes of the communist revolution. The shoe board reports a doubling of production. Of course, people still don't have shoes, but it works fine for in every other regard. That's like, and when I heard that, I thought, public schools, that's... They come in, they say, you got to get your students' test scores up. You say, okay. Can I get a smaller class? No, we can't afford that. Maybe you could hire an aide for me, a paraprofessional. No. Well, how about some supplementary? No. So you're left thinking about ways in which you can alter the appearance without actually changing the result.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You've had a good ride, starting from...
Oh, yeah. It's been a wonderful trip.
Anything else you want to change or want to look back at your...
The problem with changing things is that out of so many horrible mistakes that caused me such grief at the time, frequently came such wonderful things. I would not, under any circumstances, want to go back and teach at Barnes Junior High under that, in that situation. But had I not done that, the other stuff, I wouldn't have learned the Spanish. I wouldn't have understood the conditions there. We wouldn't have started the union, or I would not have been involved in it. I mean, if I hadn't gotten prematurely eager and married at such an early age, I wouldn't have the wonderful daughter I've got now, even though it caused me a horrible period of struggle and toil at the time. So it's kind of like that, you know. Mm-hmm. You can't, I don't think you can pull a piece out of the continuum without altering all that follows. The one thing I wish I had, I'm reminded of Bobby Lane, great University of Texas quarterback, who used to say, I never lost a game. He said, sometimes I ran out of time. I wish I had more time allotted to me. I still feel like I have a lot to contribute, but I can't do the things that need to be done. You know, we didn't talk about how it was like organizing. I alluded to it a bit, but for the first 5 or 6 years, we didn't have a travel budget in TFT.
So all out of pocket, huh?
Yeah. Drove to, if you invited me to speak in your local, you got an overnight guest and a dinner guest. Or I turned around and drove home that night, which I did a lot of. So
yeah.
Many a time I've left here, driven to Del Rio, which is about a 5-hour drive, given a speech, met with people, turned around and driven home, and then got up the next day and gone somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
That takes a toll after a while. Being president of the TFT is a little bit like being president of the national organization. There's a lot of travel, a lot of distance. And there just comes a time when the body won't go anymore, when you can't make it do that.
Yeah.
So it is a pity, but there it is.
That about it, or got something in there?
I think we've covered a lot of things.
Yeah, we have.
I guess this remains to be said.
Okay.
For all that's been accomplished in Texas, we have just made a good start. There are 275,000 certified teachers. Say another 200,000 classified employees in public schools. Higher ed faculty altogether is probably around 50,000. So we're already over 500,000 potential, and we haven't talked about support staff in higher ed. We haven't talked about any of the other organizing categories. Public employees in Texas, like state employees, are unorganized.
Mm-hmm.
Totally. There's 6,000 members of CWA, but that's it. That's it. There is so much to be done. And in the next 20 to 30 years, this state is going to undergo a transformation of significant proportion. Hispanics have made up the majority of our pupils for several years now. They will be the majority of citizens in 2020. I think minorities will be the majority in 2010. Sometime, I would say 2020, the Democratic Party people say they're more optimistic, but sometime between that 2010 to 2020 breakover period, this state is going to, unless the Democratic Party, as it's fully capable of doing, totally blunders, is going to become a Democratic state, but with a difference this time.
Mm-hmm.
Last time it was a Democratic monolith, which it was for most of my life. The Democrats were, in fact, pre-Civil War Democrats.
Yeah.
The worst kind of most repressive beliefs you can imagine. So there's a world of opportunity to be had in that period for groups like ours. And the things that can be done in the next 20 years could very well dwarf what we've accomplished in these last 20. Although it's true, I think the Democrats have an unerring ability to blunder and hardly seem to do anything else. The Republicans are just handing it to the Democrats right now.
Mm-hmm.
For a while, they weren't. When George Bush was governor, he played it so smart. He supported bilingual education. when Pete Wilson came to the state and gave a speech calling for, as he called it, immigration reform, George Bush denounced it and said, we don't want you coming to the state and talking about that. George Bush never got a majority of the Hispanic vote. That's a myth. But he did get a significant, like 20-30%, and more importantly, he did not get Hispanics turning out in record numbers to vote against him, because, like Pete Wilson, energized the Hispanics in California, because he put them to sleep.
Right.
This latest round of talk about immigration has undone all of that progress that was made when he was here. I cannot imagine. Well, he seems to be trying to have it both ways, but he ain't having it both ways. The Hispanics are not buying into his amnesty program, nor anything else, as long as they're talking about building fences.
Right.
For them, it's an issue that's much more visceral than people understand. Nancy Ibarra, Rene Lara, whom you met, Mari Tovar, all three are first generation Americans. Their parents are Americans, but they came from Mexico as illegals and then became Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Their grandparents, they still have grandparents in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
Cousins, aunts, and we're 200 miles, 250 miles from the border here. The farther south you move, the more the border becomes less and less of a dividing line and more of like a tidal basin where things slosh back and forth. And for them, what they're talking about is you can't go visit grandma for Christmas, literally.
Right.
And she can't come visit you. So, the Republican Party, and if you get, I don't know who they're going to get for president. If they get somebody in there, or somebody decides, Pat Buchanan type, the fast track to moving up in the Republican ranks is to exploit that issue. I just saw that on New York Times. I get New York Times headlines every day, and it was talking about GOP seeks to exploit porous border issue. Hey, when they start doing that, they're losing the future in Texas anyway. I don't know how that plays other places, but because the future in Texas for the Democratic Party is brown, and the Republican, and the future of any political party is brown. The Democrats right now have the market on that, and if they keep it, it'll be a transformational thing. Right now, the push against public education is coming from a coalition of entrepreneurs that think they see big bucks, and then some blacks that they have bought off.
Mm-hmm.
But they have not been able to get that push out of the Hispanics that they like.
Probably won't unless we blunder it.
Unless it gets blundered.
Yeah. Okay, John, thanks.
Yep. Nice.